Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the special Movie Geeks United Uncut Friday the 13th interview series. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Peter Brackey, the author of the definitive book on the making of the entire Friday the 13th series. I wanted to know from you if horror movies were of a particular influence on you when you were growing up.
Oh, yeah. I was a totally bizarre child. I hated Disney movies. I didn't like Star Wars. All I watched were horror movies and dramas, adult dramas, so it was very strange. So, yeah, I would actually, every week when the newspaper would come out, I would look through all the ads, for like all the drive-in ads for, like, you know, Dr. Butcher, MD, and, you know, Hospital Hotel Massacre, all the cool grindhouse movies that I wanted to see. So I was always trying to get take me to the drive-in and not to the multiplex. So, yeah, I liked all the weird, dark stuff I wasn't supposed to watch. I think it's growing up in a slightly religious household, you know, and going to Catholic school. You know, I wanted all the dangerous, dark stuff that I wasn't allowed to see. So
yeah, you hear that a lot with kids with that upbringing. They seek out the dark side in their entertainment a lot. Mm-hmm. It's understandable. But when did you come across Friday the 13th?
Oh, God, well, I remember the, I think like most kids, I remember the advertisements. You know, back then without the internet and even like entertainment shows, the first time I'd hear about a movie was either an advertisement or something on TV. So I don't remember the commercial, but it sort of counted down all the murders in the movie, you know, and flashed the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4. So I just remember seeing that and just thinking it was like the coolest thing ever. And I couldn't wait to see, you know, people killed with arrows and axes. So, unfortunately, back then things were more regional. So, like, I didn't get the movie. I was in the suburbs of Chicago, so I didn't get to see the movie till a few months after it came out. It didn't come to my local theater. But I remember going, and the air conditioner, or I'm sorry, the heat broke in the theater. It was like in the fall in Chicago, and so I remember shivering, like sort of half from fright and half from it being like 2 degrees in the theater. But it was an amazing, wonderful experience as a kid to see it. So
yeah.
That was really cool the next day on the playground, you know, because all the other kids didn't get to see it. I was 9 years old, so I was like the coolest kid for like a week.
Yeah. So, but reviewing kind of these films as you did in your book, it's a gorgeous book too, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Where was this kind of quote-unquote slasher genre when Friday the 13th came around?
Well, you know, the weird thing is Halloween had come out, and it, you know, it was a huge hit, but my theory is slasher movies didn't really kind of evolve until Friday the 13th, because what Friday the 13th had done, which Halloween didn't do, is it mixed, you know, the slasher formula that John Carpenter had created with the gore of Dawn of the Dead and sort of the Italian, you know, mm-hmm. kind of slasher movies. So, you know, that was really, Friday the 13th was really the first movie that advertised to you that you were going to see interesting and creative murders, you know, one after
right.
the other. And once that movie came out, suddenly you had this huge wave of movies that were all sort of pitched and advertised as, like, creative and bizarre, like, you know, Happy Birthday to Me and Prom Night and Terror Train. Suddenly everything was about a mass killer killing people off in crazy ways. So
right.
I think because Friday the 13th did so well and it was marketed so specifically that way, it really started the trend, whereas Halloween obviously was hugely influential, but you know, that movie was advertised more as a suspense thriller, a horror movie, but still suspense. It was about not seeing, as opposed to Friday the 13th. It was all about what you're going to see. You know, so
yeah.
I think that's why the critics hated Friday the 13th so much, is because it was so in your face, straightforward. It's basically it was exploitation, whereas Halloween
right.
definitely had more artistic pretensions to it.
Yeah. refresh my memory. Was this still kind of the drive-in culture that went to see horror films, or was that dying off at that time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, people forget that Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Dawn of the Dead, and Halloween were all limited release films. They weren't, you know, opening on 2,000 screens by a major studio. They had play drive-ins and Grindhouse, things like that. And Halloween did so well eventually, you know, over the course of like a year or two because of the reviews. But it slowly, you know, made its way across the country. So Friday the 13th was made by Sean Cunningham. He expected it to be a drive-in movie. He thought he'd get a small release. And then when they showed it to a few major studios, there was a sort of surprise bidding war. Paramount picked it up domestically and Warner overseas. So he was shocked. So they decided to treat it like a major release of something that at the time was major. It was about 800, 900 screens. And they gave it a big advertising campaign. You know, they didn't screen it for critics, and it opened really well and did really well summer long. So, yeah, at the time it was expected to be a drive-in movie. And that's another thing that Friday the 13th really helped pioneer was this idea of major studios taking smaller drive-in kind of movies and kind of skipping them with this kind of high-class marketing campaign and seeing them do really well. So
yeah,
that was definitely the first film like that, horror film, to ever be picked up by a major studio and given a nice wide release. So definitely,
what do you,
you know. Now,
what do you,
sorry. Okay.
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
I was going to say now, you know, it's sort of evolving further where now all the major studios have their own genre divisions, like Dimension. Mm-hmm. You know, Warner has Raw Nerve, so now it's become completely legitimate for studios to not only release but make their own drive-in movies, you know, mm-hmm. and market them like mm-hmm. high-class products, you know, Saw, all those kinds of stuff.
What do you
so,
think
I mean,
the
you
studios...
Never
would have
I'm sorry.
What do you think the studios saw in Friday the 13th? Did they see just right away how this could really catch on as a great infectious audience movie, you think?
Well, I interviewed Frank Mancuso Sr., who was the president of distribution for Paramount Pictures at the time. And what he said, what he saw at the screening, the first thing was that Paramount, quite frankly, needed product for the teen market and horror product. They didn't feel like they could produce that kind of material themselves. So when he saw the film, he saw it as being very marketable. And then the other major element was the ending. He thought the ending was just so terrific with Jason popping out of the water that everyone, even the distributors, like, jumped. And if you can make, you know, a room full of distributors jump who have seen, you know, a million movies and are pretty jaded, he thought it would do really well. So, he won the bidding war, and he decided, you know, there was a kind of, they had kind of a ripe little moment in their schedule in early May, which was before the summer, and there wasn't much out there, so he kind of took a shot at marketing this little movie as a big movie, and, you know, he was right. So, yeah, it was really just right place, right time. That's what, you know, Sean Cunningham says. He got really lucky.
one of the first movies to kind of mine that teenage market?
For decades, you know, there have been I Was a Teenage Werewolf and all the space monster movies of the 50s
and 60s.
So it wasn't the first, you know, obviously movie geared towards teenagers, but I think, this is according to Frank Mancuso, this was the first time the studio had really targeted the youth market so directly with a more of a mass advertising campaign. Usually teen movies weren't really pushed that way, at least from, you know, what I was told. Again, yeah, I mean, certainly there were big movies, teen movies that come out like Rebel Without a Cause, things like that, but they were always positioned as major A-list efforts, and they didn't really take, you know, teen B-movies and promote them as anything more than B-features. So it was definitely the start. It was, you know, it was one small step on the way. I think then you saw, like, the John Hughes movies and other films in the 80s. Suddenly the teen record really exploded in the 80s, and I think in all sectors. But so far, I think it was one step. I don't think it's responsible for, you know, the entire revolution of teen marketing, but it certainly was an important step, I think.
Yeah, and what inspired you to write this epic book on the series? I mean, you've got hundreds of interviews.
Like I said,
it's a beautiful book. What inspired that journey?
It really was kind of a step-by-step process. I had written another book, which I didn't really want to write, but I wanted to get published, and so I was looking for something else to do. And I've always loved horror movies, and at the time, Friday vs. Jason hadn't come out, and there really wasn't a lot of respect given to Friday 13th. There was no DVDs, you know, special editions at the time. So I kind of felt like, wow, it's kind of interesting that here's this movie that everyone knows what it is, that gets absolutely no critical respect, and no one's actually written about it. And so I just happened to go to a screening of Friday Night Part 3 in 3D. This was 2002. They had some of the cast members show up, and all of them had kind of moved on to other professions. And I thought it wouldn't be fun to sort of maybe do something small and kind of catch up with some of these people and take a look at these kind of crazy movies that sort of kind of flew under the radar. And then step by step, I contacted Sean Cunningham, and he was really supportive. A little bit leery at first, because I guess other people tried to write books and failed. And the more interviews I did, it was just so fascinating that I kind of went overboard. And pretty soon, I was, finding people who had, one line when they were killed. And I kind of realized after like 200 interviews that I probably should, maybe scale it back. There's only so much you can fit in a book. I'd never done anything like this before. So I ended up with like literally a million pages of transcripts. And that's when I was like, okay, well, this is a little too much. So it was a huge task to edit it all down. And then what happened was publishers were interested, and, I started getting emails from people saying, wow, we'd love to see photos and other cool stuff. I mean, the fans were saying, we'd never get anything really high quality with Friday 13th. And then Freddy vs. Jason came out and did really well. So suddenly there was a renewed interest, and then New Line and Paramount were surprisingly gracious with photos. And they got a wonderful deal to, make the book, because they all wanted to see it happen. And so it was kind of a perverse idea to sort of take the slasher series and give it the sort of A-list treatment. I thought it'd be really fun and collectible, and a lot of the Jason products that started doing very well, like the Jason action figures that cost $50-$60 a pop. And so we thought, well, if there's a collector's market for Jason, then, people will be willing to pay $40-$50 for a really high quality book. So, it was just sort of a crazy idea to say, hey, let's treat Fighter Team like Star Wars, and see what happens. And it's done really well, so.
Yeah, the book is a lot of fun, and just to let you know, they'll be able to our listeners will be able to click on an icon on the homepage. They'll actually take them to the Amazon page where they can purchase the book as well. So
it's just printing already worldwide. I can't believe it. It keeps selling now with the new movie. I picked the right subject, I guess.
It really is. Tell me what the highlights of that experience. The highlights were for you, who you're most excited about meeting, what those highlights were.
I think for me, as a kid, when you love something, and you become an adult, like the chance to meet people who created something that meant something to you as a child is very exciting. Even if, they only mean something to you. I mean, obviously, aside from maybe Kevin Bacon and a couple other folks, Friday Things wasn't really known as the launching pad for, tons of A-list actors. So, I mean, I was 10 times more thrilled to meet Amy Steele, who was the star of Part 2, than I would be, Julia Roberts. Like, I could care less about Julia Roberts.
Right, I hear you.
I remember calling Amy Steele. She was one of the first interviews I saw, because I really wanted to get the lead girls and the Jasons, the main folks first, and the directors. And I chanted the phone, and I got to talk to her, and we went to lunch, and I walk into the restaurant, and there's Amy Steele waving at me, and I get to sit with her. And, I was like 12 years old again, and to me it was a huge, great deal. And I think the most fun was just hearing, at the time, how surprised everyone was that they were getting a call from me. Because for most of them, they're like, Friday 13th, like, that's something I did when I was young, and I didn't think anyone cared. This was before Freddy vs. Jason, so there was a lot of, surprise that anyone was writing about these movies. Now, of course, there's more conventions, and a lot of the people in the movies realize the fan base. But so it was kind of fun for me to kind of be one of the first ones for them to kind of remind them that this was, something that a lot of people cared about. So I think that was probably the most fun.
Well, we spoke to Adrian King and
yes,
and we're trying for Amy Steele, but so they went through a lot of the ins and outs of the actual shooting of some of these films. But in your estimation, I mean, there's been, I think, 11 films and the remake coming up.
Yeah, 12. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Why? Why has it thrived so much over the years? I'm not saying that to be derogatory.
No, it's true. I mean, even Sean Cunningham, admits, he's like, Fireteam is not a great piece of art, and no one thinks it is. It was made to be a ripoff of Halloween, pure and simple. It's very low budget, relatively crudely made. Again, I think it's just the first one was a success, like every other horror movie. They made a sequel. And I think, though, where Friday Night was kind of lucky is that unlike Halloween or Nightmare on Elm Street, where people consider the first film the best, You know, Jason wasn't even in Friday the 13th. It was his mother. So for part two, suddenly Jason's a star. So it's almost like, you know, one is like a built-in prequel, and then you have two, and then Jason sort of evolved. So, you know, Jason didn't even get his hockey mask until part three. So he wasn't really iconic in that sense. So they kept making money. And that's really, you know, as Frank Mancuso told me as well, it's like the bottom line was they made us money. So we're going to keep making them. And, again, I think the 80s was just a time in general for sequels. I mean, you saw, you know, Star Trek and Star Wars, Rocky. I mean, that was, I think, the first time when movies started going to number 4, 5, and 6. That became pretty common. So, you know, again, Halloween had, like, 9 of them. Nightmare on Elm Street, that kept going. So I think all these films were just lucky to sort of be in the right era at the right time. And each one of them had their niche. You know, Friday the 13th was the gory one, and Nightmare on Elm Street was the creative one, and I don't know, Halloween was sort of its own little thing. So, yeah, it became like a Big Mac, you know. Like, I remember just going, like, I knew every year a new Friday 13th, and I knew what I was going to get, and I couldn't wait to see the next one. But like everything else, it exhausted itself. So I think the later sequels, you know, to be honest, there was kind of an increasingly desperate series of gimmicks to kind of, you know, squeeze some blood out of them, and I think most of the filmmakers admit there probably should have been a Friday the 13th, you know, 8, 9, 10, you know, they probably outlasted their welcome, but it's hard sometimes to give up on a cash cow, so.
Yeah, that being said,
Jason, with the end of that.
That being said, what is your favorite among them?
Oh, well, I mean, the most fondest memories I have of seeing Part 3 in 3D when I was a kid, because you know, it's a combination of seeing 3D for the first time and Jason having his hockey mask and just the whole experience of it with the audience. It was just so much fun. It was so participatory, you know. There's other moments. I think seeing the final chapter, not necessarily my favorite movie, but the ending of that movie, you know, because Jason finally, we thought he was dead for good. You know, at the time we believed it was the final chapter. So I don't think I've ever seen an audience, I mean, stand up and scream and cheer like they did when Jason got killed. So that was the highlight. Yeah, all the early movies really, plus I was younger, you know. I think as I got older, you know, by the time 8 and 9 came out, you know, I was already late teens, early 20s, you know, it became more nostalgia. It wasn't really scary anymore. But for me, the early, the early ones are scarier and darker.
Just for my own curiosity, I've taken a look at the Friday the 13th Part 3D here at home. I wasn't able to see it at the theater, but I put on the glasses and everything. But I'm curious, did that work? I mean, did that elevate the film when you saw it back upon its release?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at home, I think it's the red and blue red and blue glasses. So it's not quite the same effect as seeing it in full color 3D with the polarized lenses. Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't know how it looks at home. I haven't seen it yet, but seeing it on a widescreen, like a lot of things you don't notice, just the sets and the props and, you know, the stairway in one of the scenes and the blowing clothes, everything was in 3D. So it wasn't just, you know, the silly moments with, you know, knives poking in your face. The whole atmosphere and the, I think it was shot 2.35 widescreen, which was quite wide. So you just saw a lot of things in the backgrounds and the foregrounds that are cropped from video. So it definitely takes on its own life. And the audience, and seeing with the audience, you know, people kind of commenting on the stupid, you know, 3D gags and the eyeball popping out and all that kind of stuff it's a totally different experience, you know, totally interactive.
Yeah.
So it's fun. Yeah. It's like watching Rocky Horror at home versus seeing it, you know, in a theater.
Right.
Exactly. Here's kind of a fun question. What's your favorite kill?
I actually like the one in part 7, the sleeping bag. Remember that one?
I remember that.
Yeah, grabs her and whacks her against the tree. That was got a great response. That's a good one. I actually like his entrance in 3. The first time you see him in the hockey mask, he comes out with a spear gun and shoots the girl in the eye, and that's a great effect. So that was good. It's funny that, you know, somebody getting shot in the eye with a spear gets a cheer from the audience, you know. So there's a preferred kind of fun American thing about that, you know. So.
And the makeup artists are really the heroes of these movies.
Absolutely.
To a large extent. What was your experience speaking with those, particularly Tom Savini? I mean, he got his
I mean, he's very appreciative. You know, he knows that Fireteam certainly helped make him a star along with Dawn of the Dead. I think most of the makeup guys knew that the film they were, I mean, some were a little more harsh than others, but some were like, you know, I knew this movie was going to be a piece of crap, but it gave me work and a chance to be creative. I think the hardest thing was most of them, their effects were cut out, you know, from the final product because of the MPAA. The series went on, so most of the effects that people worked really hard for had never been seen, so I think it was a double-edged sword for a lot of them, or it just gave them a chance to elevate them to more of a studio level of a project, but then their work is never seen by people. So, because even to this day, I think, aside from the first film, there's really no uncut version of any of the films available, even on video. So there's some great effects I was told about that just no one's ever seen. So that's a shame.
We just spoke to John Caglioni, who did the second one, who worked on the second one. Now, do they have a lot of problems with the MPAA? My understanding is not necessarily with the first one, but it got worse and worse with the ratings board.
Absolutely.
After that one.
Yeah, when the first one came out, you know, it was very heavily criticized for being so violent and gory. I mean, now it seems kind of quaint, but so there was a big outcry, so the MPAA, you know, started cracking down on violence in general. But specifically Friday the 13th, they were like, you know, there's no, can I swear on this? Or no?
Yeah, whatever you want.
You want
to
say.
I mean, the MPAA was like, no fucking way are we going to, you know, let Friday the 13th Part 2 or 3 pass with all the score anymore, you know. If we're going to, you know, make an example of any film, it's going to be the sequel to Friday the 13th. So, I mean, Part 2, I think they trimmed like 50 seconds, which is pretty much all the gore. I mean, those whole effects are just gone, you know, completely. Mm-hmm. So every single filmmaker of all those sequels told me that it was a very arduous process of going back. You know, they would overload the gore so they could trim it down to an acceptable level, but then it got worse and worse.
Right.
So pretty soon, you know, it was like 9-10 trips to the ratings board just to get our rating. So.
Those movies really did kind of perfect the kind of teenagers and most of the teenagers that have sex are the ones that get killed. And I'm wondering,
yes.
I know this isn't a new point, but what did the makers have to say about that kind of criticism?
Well, it's funny because I interviewed Sean Cunningham, who directed and produced the first film, and then Victor Miller, who wrote it. And Sean was like, you know, I think it's silly. It was never my intention. But Victor was very specific that when he wrote it, you know, he actually based Mrs. Voorhees on his own mother.
What a flattering portrait.
Yeah, no, really.
Yeah, so a lot of therapy there. But he specifically wanted the past event that incited her rage to be sexual in nature. You know, it's very specific that Jason drowned because kids were having sex and weren't paying attention. So, you know, when the kids came back to the camp years later, they would be having sex. And there's actually one kill. The one with Kevin Bacon and the girl are making love, and then the camera pans up, and right as you hear them orgasming, you see the shot of another kid with his throat slit. I mean, there was definite decisions made to visually and orally connect sex with death. So Sean claims that it wasn't an intention on his part, the screenwriter says there was, so definitely that pattern was set. But, you know, on the other hand, like as Sean says, you know, if you have a bunch of kids at a camp, what are they going to be doing? You know, you're not going to have some boring movie of kids, you know, playing Parcheesi and painting canoes. They're going to be, you know, show them having sex and doing drugs because that's what kids want to see. So part of it is simply exploitation, you know. There's no overt message. It's simply, let's entertain these kids and then kill them off and the audience will love it. So, I don't think any of the filmmakers really sat down and said, you know, I'm going to instill a puritanical message on the world. It was just the nature of the formula, you know, that you have teens screwing and dying on film. So, but I think the later film definitely commented on that. Like Six, for example, is very overt in its comedy and kind of parroting that whole idea. I mean, by the time the later sequels came, it was such a joke, you know, that the films themselves had to comment on it, you know. So
Right. And I'm wondering what your feelings are about the remake. What do you think it might do for the series? Are you looking forward to that?
Yeah, I don't know if I can say, but I read the script. And I personally think some fans disagree, but I think the series had kind of run its course. I don't think you could have, you know, Friday 13th Part 12, 13, 14. I mean, Jason, it's just so ridiculous at this point that in real life there was a zombie killer, like they would have shut Chris Blake down, there'd be FBI everywhere. I mean, it's just kind of absurd that this guy would be out there. So you kind of have to reboot it or do something, you know, start it over. I think from what I've seen, you know, clips and stuff, they're definitely, you know, it's definitely a Texas Chainsaw vibe. It's definitely harsh, you know, very violent, very aggressive, very dark. which I think it jives with the horror genre today. I mean, I personally kind of miss some of the fun. I mean, the early Friday nights are a little more innocent. There's a little more suspense. The new one, I think, is even more brutal, more, you know, in your face. So,
right.
But, you know, yeah, I'm excited to see. I think it's going to open really well. I mean, if My Bloody Valentine can do $25 million, I definitely could see Friday the 13th just because of the name recognition doing 30 to 40. And if it does that well, of course, it'll be a part two. I mean, I don't think the new movie's going to spawn 11 sequels, but it's definitely going to keep going for a while. I mean, they're doing Halloween too, you know, so.
Yeah.
And
do you understand or do you kind of appreciate the whole horror remake craze, the whole idea of that?
Yes and no. I mean, I think, the remakes that I've always liked were like John Carpenter's The Thing or even the Dawn of the Dead remake, where the filmmaker had a real passion or an idea to remake the movie. Now
right.
I think they're taking every single title that has any market value and remaking it just to remake it.
That's true.
To the point where the people are just remake, yeah. They're not like, wow, I have a really great idea to update the story. You know, it's, sometimes they're just taking whole new ideas and just putting an old name on it, you know. Yeah, you know, the movie's good, it's good. I don't really care, but it is kind of weird sometimes to see a remake. So I'm like, well, I know what's going to happen. Like, you know, there's nothing new here. Like, as a fan, it's sort of like the Halloween remake. It was really bizarre to watch, like, a greatest hit version of the old movie with new actors, like, told, like,
right.
in 45, like, you know, the first half of the last half, like, this 45-minute montage of the best scenes from ever this movie, and it's just like, I'm like, who's this for? Because, you know, I don't know, it's just very, it's just strange. I should totally reinvent something from scratch, or only remake bad movies, you know. Like what Steven Spielberg did for Ocean's 11, you know, most people don't realize that's a remake. The original's pretty
bad. Exactly.
Yeah. Or Scarface, you know.
Let me ask you, I had a question in mind. Let me ask you one more
question.
By doing all of these interviews and spending so much time with this, with these cast members and crew members, does it deepen your appreciation of the films when you watch them now?
Yeah, definitely, because the one thing that was, for the most part, consistent there is that, you know, they all knew, especially the later sequels, that this wasn't going to be an Academy Award-winning endeavor. You know, no one would let her any, you know, believe otherwise. They knew their crews were going to hate them. So, in a weird way, you know, people were even harder. They wanted to try to make something good. And everyone kind of put their best foot forward and also gave young filmmakers a chance to kind of get their first break and take a formula and experiment with it. So I think a lot of people dismiss the movies as being uncreative and cookie cutter, but you know, everyone tried really, really hard to do something worthwhile, and that's always laudable to me, you know. So yeah, I just really appreciated the sense of humor people had about it, also sort of the commitment to do their best with what they're given, because I think a lot of people don't realize about Hollywood is, you know, you don't walk off the bus and get offered the hours or whatever, you know. You have to kind of work your ass off in the trenches, and you know, it's like film school for people, and that's really valuable. So it's a shame critics took it so seriously. You know, I think the audience was way ahead of, and the filmmakers are way ahead of the critics in terms of, you know, this is fun stuff for people. It's not serious.
Right.
So I think time is sort of slowing it out, because now I think Fighter Team looks kind of innocent and quaint. Like, you know, my nephews watch it and think it's funny, you know. And but 20 years ago, you know, it's 30 years ago when I spent, you know, the Catholic League of Decency was denouncing it, and the critics were outraged, and it was going to rot my brain and everything. And my grandma used to take my Fangorias and throw them away, you know, because I wasn't allowed to leave them, and I'd take them in my bed. And, you know, I think Friday 13th and Not the Flash movies kind of had the last laugh, you know.
Right.
They're very American apple pie. So.
I think so too, man. It's a wonderful book, and I appreciate the book, and I appreciate the time you spent with us.
Yeah,
come back
sure.
any time, man.